This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Harriet Washington has been a fellow in ethics at the Harvard Medical School and a senior research scholar at the National Center for Bioethics at Tuskegee University. And as a journalist and editor, she has worked for publications such as the New England Journal of Medicine. But her contribution to educating, agitating, and organizing was most cogently served by her blockbuster book, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. And now she's done it again with her explosive book, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. We're joined by Harriet Washington to talk about this powerful and indispensable book on the devastating consequences of environmental racism and what we can do to remedy its toxic effects on marginalized communities. I'm interested in environmental racism, the effect of objective medical, clinical, toxic realities within our society and how they affect or how the society views the way they affect the intellectual development and health of people of African descent. Where did that interest and that imperative for these works come from, Harriet?
I saw that there were a lacunae, there were like holes in the canon. A lot of many books written, and rightfully so, about the abuse of people in work that was veiled, you know, as medical research, but actually was genocidal and murderous work. There was a lot of discussion of that among certain European peoples, but nothing about the African-American experience in this country. I also saw that in terms of intelligence, the hereditarians had basically hijacked the conversation, because even people who knew better than to believe that intelligence is something that's racially mediated and passed down from parents to children, even these people spent a lot of time refuting and arguing with this theory instead of looking at the real causes of intellectual deficits. So I saw there were holes in the canon, places, you know, information that was really important, but for some reason people weren't actually collecting and addressing, and I decided to do it.
I'm also wondering if some of what informed your writing of these works had to do with the prevalence of the theories of Shockley and the bell curve and other things, and to begin to really dispel what were ideological sway for their determinations, which were conclusory and certainly not based on any kind of medical or clinical documentation or science.
Absolutely. You know, Shockley, Jensen, and Charles Murray, Herrnstein of the bell curve, these are hereditarians. These are the people who advanced this discredited theory that intelligence is racially mediated. They're saying the same thing as the 19th century doctors in the American School of Ethnology, who espoused the same beliefs, but back then they didn't have data. They didn't even bother to close their beliefs and data. It was just naked racial bias. And so that's exactly what I was alluding to before, and that is exactly what I'm doing. I thought it was important for people to understand how deeply flawed these arguments are. Not always an easy thing to perceive, because when you have people who are PhDs in the field and who have won Nobel Prizes, it's only natural to cede authority to them. You think, oh, they're expert scientists, they know what they're talking about. But people don't understand that Shockley, for example, won his Nobel Prize for work he did with a transistor, physics. He was woefully ignorant of genetics. I mean, you read his writings about why women of color should be sterilized because they're less intelligent, and just mentally eye-rolling the whole time. He betrays a lot of naivete. So it was really important for people to understand how flawed these arguments were. And of course, I thought, I think it's equally important to understand that the causes of these problems are things that we can fix. If we choose to, we can curtail exposure to environmental poisons. We have the power to do that. but we don't actually have the will. So I thought people needed to understand that there is yet another reason why, aside from the physical illnesses that we all know about, the fact that it's affecting us mentally and behaviorally. And that's another very strong reason to clean up our environment and stop exposing generations to things that we know are acutely toxic to the mind as well as the body.
Harriet Washington, how are we supposed to understand? Let's get a couple of examples here. We have the polluted water in Flint, Michigan. We have more recently what's been acknowledged as the terrible situation that is analogous to Flint, Michigan in Newark, New Jersey, with the filter certainly insufficient to deal with the lead leaching into the water table from the piping system there. We have, of course, on a much broader plane, perhaps, looking at the environmental disaster in Puerto Rico. So talk about how those examples indeed inform the thesis that environmental racism and its assault on the American mind. How do they translate into that kind of disparate treatment, and what happens to people in those circumstances?
It's not at all complicated, unfortunately. And the first thing to understand is, despite the media's penchant for looking at various populations and telling us this is a hot spot today, this is a crisis today, they've done this repeatedly with Flint, you know, with Newark, next is going to be Pittsburgh. In the past, people with a good memory remember that we were reading these stories about Baltimore and New York a decade ago. But I say that Flint and Newark and Pittsburgh don't have a lead poisoning problem. America has a lead poisoning problem because the same thing is happening across the country. This is a consistent pattern for a variety of reasons that I explore in the book. People of color are disproportionately exposed to toxic heavy metals, pathogens that can erode intelligence, pesticides, PCBs, phthalates, all of these things are pollutants that people who have privilege, who are from whom are have a high rate of homeownership, from whom our lawmakers are drawn, these people have more of a say of what happens in their neighborhood. Also, governments are loath to locate Superfund sites and foci of toxicity in the neighborhoods where powerful white people live. That NIMBY phenomenon is a national phenomenon, not in my backyard. But for people of color, it's got an obverse, as Robert Bullard pointed out, called LULUs, locally unwanted land uses. And these people of color are relatively powerless to stop them. So when sites are located on Native American reservations and on heavily Hispanic and African American areas, you're talking about people who have lower rate of home ownership, largely due to discriminatory redlining mortgage practices. When you don't own your own home, you have less of say what happens in your neighborhood. Also, people who live in places like Houston, where people are not protected by zoning, it's easier to decide you're going to locate all the garbage dumps in an area where African Americans live, who, by the way, are not necessarily poor African Americans, solidly middle class people. If it weren't for the fact that they were people of color, there'd probably be no thought given to locating these toxic foci there. So this has been a consistent pattern, abetted by a lot of things, you know, residue of segregation and Jim Crow laws, but also contemporary decisions about location. And although very often it's been characterized as a problem of economics, the populations for a long time were described as lower-income people, low socioeconomic, but that's not true. The data show us that African-Americans with an average income of $50,000 to $60,000 a year, these people are solidly middle class, are more likely to have toxins dumped in their area and be exposed than very poor whites with an average income of $10,000 a year, extremely low income. So we're talking about an issue of race rather than economics.
And I'm speaking with Harriet Washington, author of A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. And one of the issues or examples within the book that also struck me. I had done some work in Utah, Alabama, an extremely impoverished rural area, and while I thought it was one of the lovely areas I had ever been in, bucolic, tranquil, I was told that while I was setting up a picnic lunch, not to go in that area, and the reason was that it was one of the largest toxic waste dumps in the world, where foreign countries were explicitly coming and paying the locality to deposit their toxicity. Now, so take us then to the meaning of that, to Anniston, Alabama, for example, and flesh out and help us recognize what happens and what that means to people, and what is the correlation with what you yourself point out is usually a kind of flawed metric for registering intelligence, but nevertheless useful in some ways, people's IQ. How does what happened in Anniston, for example, affect people's intellectual development? And we are most definitively talking about in people of African descent.
Well, actually, you asked me two different questions here.
I'll
talk about Anniston and its symbolic importance as a foci of toxic waste dumping. And then I'll talk about IQ as a metric. In terms of Anniston, you mentioned foreign dumping, but I have not seen that as a consistent threat. What the more consistent threat is what we have seen in Anniston, which is a confluence of industry and government choosing the site as a foci where they're going to dump or allow industry to dump known toxic materials. In Anniston, Alabama, we had Monsanto, Solucia, a variety of companies, and then we also had the U.S. Army that had a chemical munitions dump there and was leaving very toxic chemicals around. And then we also had problems with lead. So this is actually very typical. When we read in the papers about lead in the water of Flint and Newark and Pittsburgh and New York, we're only reading about a small part of the problem because people who live there are under assault by a witch's brew of toxic substances. You know, they're suffering assault by heavy metals like lead and mercury and arsenic, but they're also suffering PCBs, phthalates, and they're also suffering exposure to hydrogenated hydrocarbons. And we do not know the effects of this, the synergistic effects of all these different poisons. How do they affect the body together? It's extremely difficult to study. The studies will focus typically on one assault. But we don't know how exposure to, for example, pesticides might potentiate exposure to lead. It could be additive. It could even be synergistic, much greater than some of its parts. We don't know that. So we're operating with limited knowledge. And that kind of information is extremely difficult to garner, even if you had the collective will to do it and the support to do it. It's very hard to tease out those effects. So Anniston, people there were under assault by this multiplicity of toxic exposures. And the government, the EPA, did not help them. It was so bad that when research scientists were called in to look at the water and to evaluate its effect on the wildlife, they were dumping bluegill fish into the water, and the fish were actually dissolving. The water had so many toxicants in it, it was considered hazardous waste. So right now, parts of Anniston look like an apocalypse. Look at the wasteland. You've got people growing their gardens in plastic containers, plastic drums, because the soil is poisoned, and they can't eat the vegetables they grow there. They can't eat the fish. It's tainted. So these are the kind of things that happen out of sight of people, and also when the EPA has neglected its responsibility. Remember that we're talking about American industries and the EPA, and in this case, also the U.S. Army. So the government bears responsibility as well. In fact, quite frankly, I'm more inclined to indict the government more harshly than industry. Industry has certainly acted unconscionably in exposing people to known poisons and resisting effects to quantify the damage and to clean them up. But it's the government whose responsibility it is to keep us safe. The corporations, they exist to make money for their stockholders. They're only doing what corporations do. Doesn't make it right, but it makes it understandable. But it's the government's role to control this, to curb this, and the government has failed to do so all too often, which is why we're in the situation that we're in now.
Just putting on a lawyer's hat for a moment, there is a concept of strict liability. I'm thinking within the context, when I was in, again, Utah, Alabama, there the municipality called in these companies because there was no local farming, there was no local industry to support the populace. And initially, there was certainly some level of ignorance as to the devastation that would result from inherently toxic waste being dumped. But the question of intent and the question of inadvertence, are you also suggesting that in many of these communities that the greater problem of toxicity of environmental pathogens and pollutants, etc., is one where there is almost, would you say, an intent, a strict liability thing that should apply and doesn't, that this is no longer inadvertence that people of color and poor severely affected by these terrible pollutants within our environment?
I write in the book that in some cases, intent has been invoked to deny relief to people who have been poisoned. Historically, beginning with Afton in 1982, the government and later the federal government has said, yes, you've proved that black people were disproportionately harmed and affected, but you haven't proved an intent to harm them. And without that intent, they would not give people the relief they needed. Frankly, intent, in my opinion, as anyone who reads the book will see clearly, is completely tangential. I don't think, you know, intent doesn't matter. What matters is the foreseeable effects. I don't care whether you are racist or whether you're just greedy and that motivates you. That's not important to the people who are harmed. What is important to the people who are harmed is that your company or your organization is unleashing poisons on them that you know are going to have a harmful effect. They have a foreseeable effect. It's been documented, or you know, or you should know that these are things that are going to harm people. That's what's important. And the foreseeable effects are quite clear. Despite the attempt of industry to throw a veil over the clearly strong and foreseeable effects of their poisons, that, like I said, that's what they do in order to try to protect their profits. The problem is that all too often the government does not force them to reveal the truth. For example, the lead industry knew from the very beginning that their product was toxic. They knew that tetraethyl lead added to gasoline. They thought about using ethanol, which worked just as well and is not poisonous, but they wanted to use lead because they knew that lead was something that they could patent and make money from. And so even though they wrote among themselves it was fiendishly toxic, they used lead anyway. So the government, when it finds data like this, when it becomes aware of that, the government should enact some harsh punitive effects and should make the industry help pay for the cleanup, which it has not done.
So going back to just the concept of strict liability, if you will, that it doesn't matter whether there was intent or not. There are the actual circumstances and consequences that happen to people. So the remedy
Let me interject for a minute.
Yeah.
What I mean is that it's tangential to the welfare of the people I'm talking about. You know, of course it matters morally, but morality and ethics is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about injured people. So that's what I meant when I said it doesn't matter. From the point of view of the people who've been injured, if your child lost IQ points because of lead exposure that a company knew would be harmful, it doesn't really matter whether that company, like I said, was being racist or whether it was just being greedy. You know, your child is still injured, you deserve relief. That's what I meant.
Yes, yes, I certainly understand that. And what I meant by strict liability is when I say it doesn't matter, what matters is the consequence and that there should be a remedy. For example, an easy thing, if in public housing or apartment buildings with young children under 7, there are not window guards and a child falls out the window, there should be an automatic penalty that is punitive in nature that inures to the landlord for not foreseeing that there could have been a death or some serious injury, so that the penalty is going to apply in any event. So how do we begin to remedy? I still want more examples, but also to make sure that we don't run out of time before we look at the kind of conclusions. There is this disparity based on where people live, and where people live have everything to do with race and class. So what are the remedies? There's the issue, of course, of public consciousness, but then the issue of government, the issue of corporations. What is to be done to begin to address the irreparable harm that comes from these toxicities, these pollutants that affect people and people of color most certainly?
Yes, very good question. I think as I alluded to earlier, one very important remedy is for the government to take its responsibilities to protect the citizenry seriously and to do so. The Environmental Protection Agency, when the new administration came in, Trump appointed someone whose avowed goal had been to destroy the agency. By the time he left, he'd done a really good job. It's important to realize that the EPA was far from perfect, but ever since its creation under the Nixon administration, it had been enacting changes that were very positive and important. And these had escalated under Barack Obama, and the minute the new administration came in, they began to unravel them, to not only stop the protection that they had been offered, but also they began to reverse legislation that had been set to take effect, so that these protections began to erode. We're going backwards. One example is that mercury emissions from core alkali plants have been a huge problem in the country, and under the last administration, most of the plants were closed. There are only 4 plants remaining, and they were all scheduled to close over the past couple years. But under Trump, the EPA reversed that. They decided not to close them. Under Trump, the EPA decided to stop surprise inspections in factories and institutions. And without surprise inspections, of course, efficiency is going to go down. If people know they are coming, they're going to be, well, prepare, right? So the EPA is taking us backwards. That has to stop. It's the most important thing that has to stop. The EPA has got to begin actively protecting American citizens. And let's not forget, it's true that being a person of color puts you at heightened risk. But recent studies have shown that every American still has, well, I shouldn't say every, I think 94% of Americans show pesticide residues in their bodies, even pesticides that have been banned for 40 years. So it's a problem for all of us, and our government has to protect all of us. If it simply did that, even without special attention, you know, racial attention, then that would improve the lot of people of color greatly, because we finally have some protections, and we benefit from those more than anyone else. But it's not doing that so far. So far, the EPA seems to have 2 goals. It gives lip service to the goal of protecting the populace from environmental dangers, but its real goal seems to be in abetting business and forestalling panic, as they put it. Sometimes when an activist or another group will raise an issue saying, we have a problem with all these vanished lead plants, which are no longer there, but traces of the metal are everywhere, and people don't know that they might be living on top of these. And the EPA's response is all too often, we don't want people to panic, so we're not going to publicize this. Well, sometimes panic is the appropriate response, you know, and not panic, but let's just say incentive to act. and the EPA has got to be more active. If that one thing happened, we'd be much, much better off. That would go a very long way to remedying our problems, the EPA using the knowledge that we have.
Harriet Washington, you have taught, and you have agitated, and you help us now to take up the task of organizing, because a terrible thing to waste, environmental racism and salt on the American mind, has given us a foundation through your discourse with us, but absolutely when you read the book, which I know we all will do at this point, to take us into an enhanced and imperative discussion about the public health, really the life and longevity of people in this country, and most definitively, people of color. Harriet, I want to thank you for taking the time. Your work is tremendously important, and it really is that kind of like douse of cold water that when people become somewhat complacent about what we think we know about in environmental-based issues, the intersectionality with the class and the race issues, which are so important, you just bring to light, and it continues to jolt us out of our complacency and our white privilege, for sure.
Thank you so much, Mimi. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
We've been speaking with Harriet Washington, who deconstructs the fraudulent notion of intelligence as inherited trait. She identifies how institutional and environmental racism influence negatively cognitive abilities of those living in marginalized communities of color. A must read, a terrible thing to waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind, by Harriet Washington.
You've been listening to part one of Mimi's interview with Harriet Washington. Tune in next week for part two.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.